Letters pop out from a white background, then turn red. Netflix. A Netflix original documentary. A man, A.J. Delirio, former editor-in-chief of Gawker.com, walks along a city street.
So, this is what I received. Place the hold on your accounts to comply with a court order received on August 8th, 2016. Unfortunately, you can't use money that has a hold on it. The following funds may be greater than less than the actual money in your accounts. $230,200,000 is the amount of the hold. We may also charge you $0 for a legal processing fee, which was nice of them.
He opens a letter.
You know, I got this FedEx letter sent to me last Friday. It's from a person I don't know. It's hard to believe you're in this terrible situation, but hey, maybe when this is all over, you'll have enough bizarro Florida material to write a Carl Hyacin-esque novel. You know, look, I know it's weird to send strangers things in the mail. Just wanted to say that your writing has brought me a lot of joy in the years. She sent me $200 cash, and I don't know this person. This is just something that I am caught in the middle of and trying to figure out the best way to get through it. I found out that it was actually going to trial. I knew right then that something really bad was going to happen.
An imposing modern building.
Don't be fooled into thinking that just because this case is so sleazy and rests on sex, that it's not important. This is one of the most important First Amendment cases in American history.
In large, bold letters, Illuminant Media and Subla Production.
Hulk Hogan, one of the greatest wrestlers of all time, just got totally sucker punched.
Hogan is suing the website Gawker for publishing a video that shows him having sex with the former wife of radio personality Bubba the Love Sponge.
He had sex with his best friend's wife, and he agreed to it.
It's the first celebrity sex tape case to go to trial.
It put internet privacy in a battle against freedom of the press.
Well, withheld from the jury.
In the background, a man speaks on TV in association with the Filmmaker Fund.
There's a mechanism through which a billionaire can game the judicial system to go after journalism it doesn't like.
They knew exactly what they were doing. I wasn't in line with them politically as a columnist. I was more feisty than they were used to. For whatever reason, I was perceived as an enemy.
In the background, Donald Trump, in association with First Look Media and Field of Vision.
We're talking about more than just a trial or an election or even freedom of the press itself. We're talking about the very notion of truth.
Build the wall!
What is true?
I will kick your ass.
What is false? What is reality?
Trump floors an opponent at a wrestling show, a film by Brian Knappenberger.
It does worry me that 5, 10, 20 years from now, we will look back and say, oh, this was the beginning of that, when the nature of the freedom of press in America changed.
Our society really needs strong, independent, and adversarial journalism. And if we lose that, we will be very much poorer and very much endangered. People need to realize that this is under threat right now.
The title types out, Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press. Footage of a political rally. Fights break out. Blurred cell phone video of riot cops advancing with batons.
Journalism, you know, real journalism, the kind of journalism that exposes things that powerful people don't want known, is a very fragile thing.
Sir, I want to talk to you.
It's a very rare thing. It doesn't happen most of the time. It can disappear very easily.
I have never heard or seen such outrageous, vicious, distorted reporting.
The world's most dishonest people are back there. Look at all the cameras going.
I would never kill them. I would never do that. That's sick.
there was political traction to be won by essentially conducting culture war against big media. That's become a standard way of doing politics.
Can you turn her microphone off, please?
No.
Turn her microphone off so I can talk.
We're going to open up those libel laws, folks, and we're going to have people sue you like you never got sued before.
The Gawker-Hulk Hogan-Terry Bollea case happened against a backdrop of distrust of the media.
Hulk Hogan filed two lawsuits today in Tampa, Florida.
Charles Harder, Hogan's attorney.
The first lawsuit was filed in the Florida State Court. It was filed against Heather Klemm and her ex-husband, Todd Allen Klemm, also known as Bubba the Love Sponge. The allegations in that lawsuit state that approximately 6 years ago, the Klemms secretly videotaped Mr. Hogan having private, consensual, intimate relations in a private bedroom. The second lawsuit filed today was filed in the United States District Court for the Middle District of Florida. It was filed against Gawker Media and its related entities and individuals.
With Hogan in the background, a title types out. Bollea versus Hogan. Dunes under gray skies and the locations, Petersburg, Florida.
There were so many things brought into play here and so many things at stake.
The Pinellas County Judicial Building.
You have questions of where lines are drawn for privacy in an age of immediate broadcasting. You have the question of who gets to set the taste for the country. What's appropriate? You have the question of to what degree is sex a matter of public concern when it occurs in private domain.
David Folkenflik, NPR.
There's the question of what an independent publisher can do without the backing of some sort of wealthy billionaire.
Good morning, Mr. Bland.
Morning, Gus.
How you doing?
All is well, man.
Anything you want to say to your fans?
This yeah, man, I'm getting ready. Here. I'm training for another title shot. Yeah, I'm getting in good shape. Belly's gone, arms are jacked up. Yeah, just looking for another giant slam.
So you have all these different dynamics sort of colliding in this courtroom in Florida.
Hogan in a dark suit, black bandana, and silver crucifix enters the court.
And you knew from the day it started that it was going to be an important one, but also a fascinating one. Big stories where big issues are at stake don't often resolve into perfectly neat morality tales, right?
Could you describe the character Hulk Hogan for the jury, please?
The character's larger than life. It's the all-American character. The theme of the training, prayers, and vitamins, and believing yourself is like what we'd call the four demandments of the Hulkamaniacs. And the all-American image of the character's tan, full head of hair, used to. Just even my theme song is Fight for the Rights of Every Man. He's the all-American hero in a nutshell. The character, Hulk Hogan.
White mustachioed Hogan sits in the witness box. Boxers training, Gleason's Gym, Brooklyn, New York. David Bixenspan, freelance journalist.
It's hard to overstate just what a big deal Hulk Hogan was at his peak in the 80s and the early 90s.
Weighing 320 pounds, the incredible Hulk Hogan.
He was the centerpiece of the WWF, going from being a very successful, because it was in major population bases, but regional company, into being a national and then international company.
You shall feel the wrath of Hulkamania. This is where the power lies.
They needed the biggest, most charismatic star they could find, and they lured away Hulk Hogan, and he was the key to that. Making more money than any wrestler ever had before.
Who's your favorite rockin' wrestler?
Even, yeah, The Rock didn't have his own cartoon.
Yay!
He had his own line of vitamins, which were one of the biggest selling line of children's vitamins in the country. He was always on in public in a way that a lot of wrestlers are, but it was almost different for him. Like, he just couldn't cease being Hulk Hogan. Whether it was on The Tonight Show or doing deodorant commercials
and the freshest
or whatever. I mean, he's Hulk Hogan. He's never Terry Bollea.
Look at that!
Does your license say Hulk?
Sure. No, it doesn't. It says Terry.
Terry?
Terry Hulk Hogan.
Oh,
they know
Terry.
That, man. That's no surprise. Yeah, they know that.
2007 is a very weird time period for Hulk Hogan. There are a lot of things going on. His marriage is falling apart while his family's shooting a reality show. He was clearly not doing great.
I'm done with it.
The imposing judicial building. Hogan sits with his legal team.
You have a Florida jury that's more accustomed to Terry Bollea, or we know as Hulk Hogan, as a hometown star, and a kind of disdain for these guys tromping in from the media capital of the world and thinking they can just play with somebody's life as though they're just characters on a screen.
Nick Denton, founder of Gawker Media, is sworn in.
I was always a geek. I was a technology obsessive. I actually used to, when I was in Budapest, I used to get the train to Vienna to pick up Wired magazine because I was kind of obsessed about technology. So from about 1996, I was writing about the internet and technology. And then I lobbied to be based in Silicon Valley in San Francisco in order to be closer to the center of the action there.
A title types out, New York, New York. Offices of Gawker, June 2016.
I came from a traditional British newspaper journalism background. Seeing the first blogs, the barrier between the thought, the idea, and the page, and potentially to millions of readers, the barriers had all come down. Complete revolution. We launched Gizmodo, a tech site, and then Gawker.com, which became our flagship news site. My idea was a very basic one. What if you actually were to take the stories that don't get published, the stories that journalists exchange amongst themselves, the kind of the behind-the-scenes look at what's really going on? Everybody knows that what usually appears, certainly in the establishment media, bears very little resemblance to what's really going on.
Elizabeth Spears, co-founder of Gawker.com.
We're both outsiders who, I think, gravitated to New York for similar reasons. Both of us would latch on to the specific things about New York culture that made it unique and hilarious and very often just absurd. We had no idea that it was going to explode. I think people reacted to it partly because of the tone for people who considered Gawker frivolous. They felt like it was, you know, people going from eating their vegetables to, you know, mainlining heroin.
The whole idea was to flout convention, to thumb its nose at the establishment, at the expected mores, at how the proper press was supposed to behave. What respect you afford a person who is, to some degree or significant degree, public. But that was a consistent theme. Where's the line?
I definitely cultivated an image as a publisher who always puts the story first, which can come across as being ruthless.
We publish stories ahead of maintaining relationships with people without access, favor, or discretion.
The mean girls who just, you know, ran the show and laid waste to everyone they saw, you know, that's Gawker. They rule the playground. It's partly because they'll say unspeakable things.
I went on to see what was there today, and it just said how fat Kevin Costner was, and then it had a picture of Jabba the Hutt next to him. Make I just want you up. To think about your life and, you know, just
wow.
You know, weigh your options. And I mean, because I would hate to see you arriving in hell and somebody sending a text message saying, guess who's here?
When the story comes out and that people don't like, it's convenient to say, oh, this is a journalism organization beyond the pale, or this story is mean-spirited. You know what? The world is mean sometimes. People are mean. The participants are mean. Sometimes, actually, the truth is ugly. What do you want?
John Cook, former executive editor, Gawker Media Group.
What excited me about Gawker was I did a story on Bill O'Reilly, and someone said to me after the story came out, you know, no one punches Bill O'Reilly in the face. And I was like, well, yeah, I just punched him in the face. You know, I wanted to write true things about bad people. And that's what Gawker gave us all the freedom to do, was to look at people who were full of shit, full of hot air, abusing their power, you know, being bad or obnoxious or cruel or unkind. And we could, you know, give them what for? Internet culture. There's so much just bullshit and hot air. There's so much just fakery and fraud and lies in Silicon Valley, in the media business. And to have a place that was willing to just to puncture all that and could do it entertainingly and truthfully and honestly, it was incredibly refreshing.
Don't do it.
The kids
are important to you. That's what drives you, baby. That's what I love.
Gawker.com is the site that exposed the mayor of Toronto as a crackhead and was the first to raise serious questions in this latest phase about Bill Cosby and the accusations of sexual misconduct and putting Quaaludes in women's drinks. Gawker.com is the site that first raised questions about Hillary Clinton's email server when her email address was revealed by the Guccifer hack. I put out the story about Tom Cruise's role as chief marketing officer, pretty much, of the Church of Scientology.
We are the authorities on getting people off drugs. We are the authorities on the mind. We are the authorities on improving conditions.
So Gawker.com has a long, illustrious history of putting out great stories that weren't being written about. And I think in the media ecosystem, you need at least a few people who are prepared to offend or insult.
Stars and Stripes flies outside the judicial building. Nick's team meet in the parking lot. John Cook.
What was at stake was the future of the company, of the entire project. He and his attorneys had very successfully dragged us down to Florida. You know, this should have been a federal case, and they tried in federal court. They tried a copyright claim in Tampa in federal court, and those both got bounced. A decision from a U.S. district court judge that said this was newsworthy. It's protected by the First Amendment.
The reason to save Gawker is not because Gawker was worth saving. The reason to save it is that we don't pick and choose what sort of publications are permissible, because once we do, it empowers the government to limit speech in a way that ought to be impermissible. Even the most disagreeable speech is, as a general matter at least, fully protected by the First Amendment.
Floyd Abrams, First Amendment attorney.
Judge Pamela Campbell, her claim to fame before this was that she was the lawyer for the parents of Terri Schiavo. Her parents refused to let her have her feeding tube removed, and Campbell was their lawyer. Jeb Bush appoints her to this position as a judge in Pinellas County. As jury selection begins, Judge Pamela Campbell makes these comments to the jury about how she's unhappy with the state of journalism and online journalism.
AJ comes out of the building.
He's got matches.
I really wish I had some.
The funny thing about this case, you know, the whole 2 years, I think, since I found out it was going to trial, it always felt off. It always felt like there was something else happening.
You're the editor-in-chief, all right?
Yes.
So we have moved up through the decades. At some point, did you learn about a Hulk Hogan sex tape, or a tape purportedly involving Mr. Hogan engaged in sex with a woman?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I received an email from someone who said that he had a client that was interested in sending me a package. You know, he hinted at what it was, but he couldn't say who his client was or how he had come into possession of what was the Hulk Hogan sex tape. And I said, sure, send it on. I mean, these are things that happen kind of routinely, and especially to me.
Who was it that broke this story about there possibly being a Hulk Hogan sex tape out there?
It was TMZ.com.
Okay.
A few places like Dirty published screenshots from the tape, people trying to get their hands on it.
At that time, 2012, celebrity sex tapes had gone from the Pam Anderson, Tommy Lee, Kim Kardashian, to, you know, the Dustin Diamonds. It seemed like everyone was having one leaked. You know, this person wanted no money for this, just wanted me to watch it. And And I did.
Could you recognize anyone that appeared in the video?
Yeah, I recognized Hulk Hogan.
Okay. And could you recognize anyone else?
There was a woman in the video as well, which, according to other previously reported news, was rumored to be Heather Klemm. And then there was also a male voice at the beginning of the recording, which, according to other reports, seemed to be Bubba the Love Sponge.
Six times the fireworks.
No fear, nothing to lose.
Six times the stupidity.
Are you all right? Hold on.
On the Bubba the Love Sponge show.
Bubba the Love Sponge, who himself is like a celebrity in his own right.
Pay some homage to the man.
Before all this, nationally, I would think he was best known for the time where he claimed to be slaughtering a hog on air to eat.
You want to skin, want him to skin the hog?
Yeah, we're going to, Richard, we skinning the hog, we're going to put it on the grill.
Once he threatened to burn the Koran on the air, and the CIA, I believe, actually had to reach out to him through Jill Kelly. Jill Kelly had to reach out to Bubba because apparently they had credible information that him burning the Koran on the air would be a national security threat.
Bubba was married to this woman, Heather Klemm. Their relationship was one where he would watch her have sex with other men. And one of those men happened to be Hulk Hogan, who was his best friend, best man at his wedding.
AJ Delario basically gives it to a video editor at Gawker and says, cut this into like a 30-second, a minute-long kind of highlight reel. Then he does a post about the Hulk Hogan sex tape.
When we published the Hogan story, no one cared. There was not, like, we've published a lot of stories that people are shocked and outraged, and we feel that outrage. We get a lot of anger and hate and resentment back. Some of it justified. Hogan did not have that dynamic at all.
Hogan arrives at court.
Our request of Gawker was quite simple. Take it down, we walk away. That was it. We didn't ask for anything. We didn't demand anything, save and accept. In the name of decency, if nothing else, take it down, we walk away. It was not a situation that needed to be publicized for the good of the American people, or for that matter, the world community. Quite to the contrary. It was salacious, it was ugly, and mean-spirited.
David Houston, litigation counsel.
I also sent a more personalized email to Mr. Denton in particular, because again, I didn't want him to regard my letter to his corporate counsel or his editorial staff as a direct challenge. Okay, you want to fight? Let's go fight. You know, meet me at the bicycle rack at 3 o'clock. It wasn't about that.
Do you remember getting the cease and desist letter from David Houston?
Nick Denton.
Yes.
You didn't find it persuasive enough to compel you to pull this video off?
We passed it to legal, considered it, and yes, I didn't find it persuasive.
It's funny, lurid, it's kind of interesting and newsworthy, and that he's this American icon. You know, an American hero, a role model for kids.
Hogan parades around a ring waving a small flag.
Images from that sex tape have actually already been published. Hulk Hogan had talked about the sex tape being making the rounds on TMZ. In fact, even after we did our story on Gawker, he went on Howard Stern's show to joke about his performance.
Okay. Can we talk about this sex tape thing?
Sex tape.
All right, wait. So let me understand what's going on.
Hogan actually been using his own sex life as part of his image.
Jimmy Fallon.
There's a Hulk Hogan sex tape going around the internet.
You know, when you see the words Hulk Hogan sex tape, you know, you have that moment before you decide whether or not to click it. I feel like that's about as close as you can get to being able to stare into your own soul.
I understand why a lot of people were not just upset, but revolted at Gawker. It was very rough. It was often very mean. They seemed to take great pleasure. So it's really understandable that people were angry at it. There are a lot of people I know who represent newspapers, the press bar, who are saying, well, you know, we wouldn't do that, which is, of course, true. And, of course, that's fortunately not the standard we use in deciding what's legally protected and what not. What was needed here was an acceptance that the First Amendment has a role to play, that even this sort of material about that person who had said those things about himself so publicly and repeatedly has to be protected.
During the trial, Terry Bollea, the real human being who is under all these layers of this cartoon character that we know of as Hulk Hogan, said that he was hurt by the posting of this video. He said, listen, I may have boasted about things in character as Hulk Hogan on radio in my public appearances, but that's very different from how Terry Bollea feels when the doors are closed and I'm having a private moment. And this has been devastating to me.
I knew before I went to New York that Gawker had put the tape up. But when TMZ called me, they confirmed my worst fears, that the only one person that I had left, because my wife had taken off with my kids at that time, the only person I had left was this camaraderie with Bubba, my friend. And as bad as everything was and as horrible as I felt about it, and just everything was going to hell in a handbag, I still held out hope because he was telling me he did not do this to me. And when Mike Walters said he saw it and the executive producer saw it, I remember being on the phone with David Houston, and I started, my arms have never done this before, my hands started shaking violently, and I got off the phone. And I didn't go into a spasm, but it was one of those things where I couldn't quit shaking. David, I finally answered the phone back after David called me several times, and he talked me down because he was the only person that I had in my life that I believed loved me and actually just was my friend.
The photo of Hulk Hogan with his hand on Bubba's shoulder.
I was pretty rocked. I felt numb.
He kind of comes up with this new argument that Gawker invaded Terry Bollea's privacy, whereas all of the bravado and bombast on Howard Stern or in his memoirs or in his reality show, all of that was a performance that Hulk Hogan was giving, not Terry Bollea.
And from there, it just gets weirder and weirder and weirder.
Let me ask you this. Just let's see if we can simplify this. Do you have any doubt, as you sit in that witness stand today, that you were discussing the length of your penis on Bubba's radio program? Any doubt?
Well, it's not mine, because mine isn't that size, but we were discussing the length of Hulk Hogan's.
Seriously? So...
No, seriously, I do not have a 10-inch penis. No, I do not. Seriously. Okay.
Fair enough. So what you're telling us is you were discussing...
Believe that.
Hulk
seriously.
Hogan's penis, right?
Excuse me?
You were discussing Hulk Hogan's penis.
Yeah, because Terry Bollea's penis is not 10 inches like you're trying to say.
All right.
And I go like this in the courtroom because I was just shocked. I was like, well, this is actually being said in a courtroom right now. This is Hulk Hogan, who was suing for $100 million, saying all this bizarro shit.
You didn't think that was invasive of your privacy, right?
My privacy?
Yes.
Terry Bollea?
Or Hulk Hogan?
We've talked about Hulk Hogan several times. I need to make you understand this, that Hulk Hogan gave up his privacy the moment he walked out his front door, became a celebrity in anonymity. And so I don't like talking about Hulk Hogan's penis, but I've already tried to explain to you, I gave up my right as Hulk Hogan to have Hulk Hogan have any privacy. Okay. I don't know how much clearer I can make that to you.
All right.
I'll do whatever I can to help you, but I just don't know whatever else to say to make you understand that.
Fair enough.
What a cartoony explosion of truth about America is coming out here. There is a bargain that the press has made for a long time that celebrities are allowed not to lie, but to puff themselves up. And in advertising law, by the way, there is this cookie is the best cookie in the world. You know, this car will attract dames, you know. And that is called puffery, and it is legal, which is what I think Hulk Hogan was doing with his penis size, his sexual exploits, his prowess, and what all the way up to Donald Trump has been doing is puffery. You know, he hopes that the Russians will find Hillary's 33,000 emails and publish them.
I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press.
He said he was being sarcastic.
That was Leslie Savan, media critic, The Nation. Trump wrestles an opponent.
Can you cast your public persona out in a lie?
You're fired.
When Donald Trump was criticized for his misogynist remarks, one of the defenses against that attack was that, oh, well, he was just saying these rude things about women. That was his TV personality.
A lot of those statements is what Mr. Trump made as a television character. So I don't think that some of that is going to stick. Again,
I don't know where that leaves journalists. I think at the very least, even if we're not going to actually call them out in out-and-out lies, although I don't see why not. I don't see why a character should be immune from that.
Nick and AJ in the parking lot of the courthouse. Nick grins and spreads his arms.
You good?
David Fulkenflick.
In the lead up to this case, I talked to a number of people at Gawker as well as other people who are watching the conflict build. And they clearly were wondering how it was that Terry Bollea, who's had some financial distress, would be in a position to pursue a suit like this. One of the most intriguing things during the lawsuit was that a charge was dropped by Terry Bollea at a key moment. And people who are following the lawsuit are saying, why the heck would they do that? I mean, they're throwing everything at us. Why on earth would they drop a charge? The charge here was the infliction of emotional distress. And that was one of several elements of this lawsuit. The infliction of emotional distress fell within the parameters of an insurance policy about the infliction of bodily harm. Once that charge was dropped from the civil suit, the insurance company walks away. And that meant that Gawker, that Nick Denton, that the former editor were themselves very much financially exposed to the harm that could be caused by this lawsuit. It was like a missile about to go off.
So by reducing that claim, Hulk Hogan doesn't stand to win so much, ultimately, but then we can't pay for the costs through insurance.
That's strange.
That's very strange.
Because you'd think that someone in Hulk Hogan's position would go for the biggest financial windfall.
Yes.
There's no reason that they would be doing that if the goal here was to maximize Hulk Hogan's recovery of damages. The only reason to do that is to destroy the company.
We had a suspicion that there was somebody. This has cost $13 million in legal fees for us so far. It suggests that there's another agenda. Some of the lawyers would occasionally raise this possibility with me.
Nick refused to believe it because he didn't want to get wrapped up in any kind of conspiracy theories. From my perspective, it was a sense of like creeping dread. The way they litigated it, the way they litigated this into the ground. Every question that could be briefed was briefed. It was just very clear that they were basically like trying to rack up billable hours on our side. They would come down to hearings in Tampa and like stay at really nice hotels. And like, who's paying for this stuff, right? Is this a contingency case?
Bollea's motivations aren't entirely clear because there was an additional tape on which he was having sex in which he was reported to have used racial epithets against African-Americans of the most hideous kind.
Gawker will argue that Hogan was aware that on one of the sex tapes, he was using racist and homophobic language. And that is the real reason that he sued Gawker. And if they published that, it would definitely be newsworthy and it would destroy his career.
A Gawker headline, David Houston.
When we first got word as to Gawker and what Gawker had done, you know, one might consider that a bad day. It was going to get worse. We actually, meaning me, I was contacted by an individual who described himself as a lawyer who represented certain individuals that had the entire sex tape. And really, this little bit that was given to Gawker was to constitute a shot across our bow to let us know they were serious about selling this tape to the media or publicizing it. And if we wanted to, we could engage in meaningful negotiations to purchase that particular sex tape. And my first thought, and I expressed it verbally, was this is the same thing as extortion. And I was reminded by my counterpart that they didn't consider it such. They consider it a business deal.
Thanks for coming back, along with your attorney, Keith Davidson. Thanks to both of you.
Keith Davidson is an arguably disgraced lawyer from Los Angeles who's living in some form is based on being a sex tape broker. He made a name for himself doing that. He got involved in the whole dust-up over the Vernon Troyer sex tape. Yes, there's a sex tape of Mini-Me.
This individual actually apparently made a living brokering sex tapes. And I just couldn't believe that somebody openly did that.
Flags fly outside the courthouse.
Yeah, met with the FBI on a number of occasions. A sting operation was actually set up where we were all to gather and meet in a hotel in Clearwater Beach, Florida, at which point in time this individual would receive from us a rather substantial check, and in turn he would turn over to us what he claimed to be the only and the original of this sex tape. The FBI on the appointed day was also present and operating out of this hotel, had rented the room directly next door, had wired up the room we were in with audio.
Am I correct to assume that the person who we're going to see today is not the person who actually got the tapes, but rather somebody acting on their behalf?
Playback of the recording.
Okay, so they're kind of working together. They don't want to reveal themselves, so they don't want their identity known. Okay.
The Luxury Hotel, David Bixenspan.
And they watch various parts of the video. What they haven't seen or heard yet is that on one of the other two videos, he uses the N-word. A lot. And he makes various homophobic comments.
That's bad. It's hard for me to watch, thinking that that guy was my friend all those years.
Yeah, it's one thing to hear about it. It's one thing
I mean,
to...
it's just like...
to read it.
And he was there when my father passed away. Leaning over the bed with me. I mean, it just totally blows my mind to see that.
That's just the absolute, man.
Crazy.
When the deal, if you can call it that, was concluded, they, of course, came in through all doors possible, down on the ground, et cetera, got Belay and I out of the room very quickly, which resulted in the immediate detention of the attorney from Los Angeles and his cohort.
Hulk Hogan's $100 million lawsuit over a tape that was posted online by the website Gawker. Hogan claims it's an invasion of privacy. Gawker argues he's fair game and it's news.
Nick is filmed by the press.
Do you mind getting a little bit further back?
During the Hogan-Gawker lawsuit, during the discovery process, Gawker finds out about this whole FBI investigation and sting.
It was disclosed that Mr. Belay engaged in horribly racist rant on this tape.
But Judge Campbell had ruled at the time that this stuff was attorney's eyes only.
During the course of the Gawker investigation, there was also a leak of a transcript, and that leaked transcript found its way to the National Enquirer and Radar Online.
The Enquirer tips off WWE, where Hogan was working at the time as kind of a goodwill ambassador and appearing on TV occasionally. They immediately cut ties with him, delete every mention of him from their website, and he's gone.
Today, World Wrestling Entertainment terminated the contract of one of its biggest stars, Hulk Hogan.
Now, Hogan's reputation is in tatters.
The most famous professional wrestler of all time is no longer a WWE Hall of Famer.
What was in that leaked transcript was the racial epithets that Mr. Belay said and admitted he had uttered, and admitted it was stupid, it wasn't meant the way it was being taken. But once that happens and people run with it, they try to tag you with a racist tag, despite the fact that numbers of people came out in support of Mr. Belay and said nothing could be further from the truth. The question became who leaked that information to the National Enquirer.
A still of Nick.
It was Den's hope that the media would think, Terry Belay didn't file this lawsuit because he was hurt by what Gawker had done. He filed it simply to avoid the release of these, quote, racial epithets that were contained within the transcript the FBI had done of the tape. Nothing could have been further from the truth.
The evidence suggests that, yes, that's what he was concerned about. He sends a text message to Bubba the Love Sponge. The best friend, former best friend who made the recording, and sends a text message, clearly indicates that he's worried more about this other recording and the racist language. The irony is that that probably would never have come out. It would have come out. I don't know. I don't think it would have come out.
Palms sway outside the courthouse. AJ sits with his legal team.
The defendants list was a lot longer before it just got down to me. And I couldn't figure out the whole time, like, why am I still on this list? I'm the guy that wrote the posts. I had some editorial power, but at the same time, the decision to keep up the portion of the sex tape that, I mean, was apparently the thing that was, you know, causing all this problem, that goes above my head.
Do you remember a portion of your deposition that was played where you talked about what kinds of hypothetical celebrity sex tapes would not be newsworthy?
Yeah, I do.
The moment where it really starts to seem like Hogan is winning the trial is when they play back part of AJ Delario's deposition.
Can you imagine a situation where a celebrity sex tape would not be newsworthy?
If they were a child.
Under what age?
Four.
You were joking? Is that what you just said?
I did say that, yeah.
Do you think that's a funny topic to joke about? Child pornography?
No, not at all.
Clearly, I'm kidding. Who would actually think that? And I was just reacting to a person that was sitting across from me who was doing everything possible to take away something that I loved, which was Gawker, and harm them. And, you know, I reacted.
These are the people who write and distribute these stories. This is the guy who wrote the story. His name is A.J. Delario. He shocked the jury when he testified that the only sex tape he would not publish was one involving a child under the age of four.
It was the worst days of my life. I felt so horrible for how Gawker was being portrayed over all this.
After Hogan initially filed the suit against Bubba the Love Sponge Clem and Heather Clem, saying that they secretly recorded him, Bubba goes on his radio show and says, actually, Hogan knew he was being taped.
This was an act that all parties knew about everything.
Did everyone know about the tape?
Everybody knew about everything.
Okay.
Later, Hogan and Bubba settle for, I think, $5,000 and an agreement to help Hogan go after Gawker.
We weren't allowed to put Bubba on the stand. He pleaded the fifth. And we weren't even allowed to put him on the stand to make him plead the fifth. The judge said, oh, well, don't let's not bother him. The irony here is that, like, the sort of the spirit of Gawker is, like, what the story behind the story is, what's really happening. And we're stuck in this situation where we had this very sort of filmic story about Hogan's effort to prevent the release of this other tape that was really damaging. And we couldn't tell any of it. We couldn't say any of it to the jury. It was just this, it was a sham trial.
The jury knows nothing about this. They weren't able to impeach Heather's testimony. Whatever you think about what Gawker did, they didn't really get a fair shake here.
Houston and Hogan leave the courthouse.
How'd it go today, Hall?
Today was another good day. Every day's a good day. David, how'd it go today?
Went very well. Went awesome. Better than we could have ever hoped for. Every day just seems to get better and better.
Hogan has his hand raised, being sworn in.
This case became more of a juggernaut. It built up steam, and it started to become stronger and stronger and faster and faster. Literally, all that I could do is look back behind Gawker and see nothing but the debris of defeat. It was everywhere.
There was this sort of relentless march forward that we couldn't get off the track, couldn't stop. It was coming at us, and there wasn't a lot we could do.
We need to return the following verdict. The plaintiff proved that by posting a video, defendants publicly disclosed private facts about plaintiff in a manner that a reasonable person would find highly offensive. Yes. The plaintiff proved that the video was not a matter of legitimate public concern. Yes. Did Nick participate in the posting of the video on Gawker.com? Yes.
Hogan breaks down crying at the verdict. I mean, whatever you think this means to him, I mean, whatever that actually is, it clearly meant something. And he's crying.
and they award him $115 million in compensatory damages.
And they go back and they come out and they say, we find punitive damages of $15 million against Gawker, $10 million against Nick, and $100,000 against Delario.
Florida jury speaking out after awarding Hulk Hogan $140 million in damages. Gawker will have to pay up for the online publication of a sex tape. The jurors say they would have awarded Hogan even more. But the judge warned them not to bankrupt Gawker and its founder, Nick Denton.
Posters headed guilty show Nick behind bars.
State courts have a history of offering really, shall we say, inflated judgments. This was one on steroids.
That's insane. I mean, if you talk to any legal experts, it's insane. You know, it's a multiple of like the highest normal award for a wrongful death lawsuit.
One of the jury members said later that I showed no remorse. My face was blank. I was conscious of the fact that there were cameras on me. And I believed that we were in the right.
I am confident that we would have prevailed at trial if we had been allowed to present the full case to the jury. That's why we feel very positive about the appeal that we have already been preparing. And we expect to win this case ultimately. Thank you very much.
The size of the award and the demand to start putting up the money are what the lawyers call an enterprise-threatening event. And that's what makes it so dramatic and so disturbing that the size of the award was essentially a death sentence for this newsroom.
The notion that the publication will cease to exist is something itself extraordinary and very dangerous. Even if you conclude the worst about Gawker, the idea, first, that they should have lost this case, and second, the idea that they should be gone. The whole situation about this case is extremely problematic.
That was Floyd Abrams, a title, billionaire behind the scenes.
Nick Denton becomes convinced that there's somebody financing this lawsuit, and that's got somebody who's got no other real connection to Terry Bollea. It's not one of his friends, it's not his family, that it's somebody else with a different agenda. The New York Times publishes what's essentially a speculative piece pointing a finger at a Silicon Valley billionaire.
It comes out that there's some secret funder doing this behind this, and I thought, what?
Forbes reports that it's Peter Thiel. The day after that, Peter Thiel admits it to the New York Times on the record. It's like, wow.
It is really amazing to think about what we've learned in the past few hours about this.
CNBC's Andrew Ross Sorkin confirming that billionaire Peter Thiel, a co-founder of PayPal, early Facebook investor with a net worth estimated at $2.7 billion, is secretly paying the expenses of Hulk Hogan's legal fight.
A remarkable story and a remarkable revelation. The country gripped by this Hulk Hogan story for many, many months this past year.
You're talking about someone who is so rich going after an independent publisher, right? So that those are the key factors here. That is sort of unprecedented.
Media critics who have similar views that this is a new threat to democracy and to free speech if billionaires or multimillionaires can be behind the scenes secretly financing lawsuits against news organizations.
This is personal.
Yeah. He's doing this because he wants to bring Gawker down.
John Cook works at his laptop.
It was scarcely believable. Something so cinematically vindictive and conspiratorial and underhanded could actually happen.
AJ.
I didn't think it was going to be apocalyptic, but it happened that way. And the weird part about today is just like now I know what a colossal waste of time that whole trial was. That was not even the goal. This has nothing to do with me. This has nothing to do with Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan's, you know, a pawn, and right now I'm just a patsy in this whole ordeal. You know, everyone involved in Gawker's side knows that we're just completely outgunned here.
Traffic flows through a city. A title announces San Francisco, California. Views of a door marked BuzzFeed, Open Lab. Will Alden, business reporter, BuzzFeed.
Peter Thiel's considered one of the smartest people in Silicon Valley. He became famous in the late 90s and early 2000s with PayPal.
You know, he was the CEO at one point. He was a co-founder. He was also very famous for being a very early investor in Facebook. He runs a venture capital fund. In the past, he's run a hedge fund. So he's kind of investor slash entrepreneur slash philosopher king type who gives public talks and wrote a book.
There are businesses that are perfectly competitive, and there are businesses that are monopolies. And there's shockingly little that is in between. And this dichotomy is not understood very well because people are constantly lying about the nature of the businesses they're in.
In the show Silicon Valley, there is a character based on Peter Thiel.
The cicadas of Myanmar emerge every 13 years, while the Brazilian cicadas emerge every 17.
He's got a lot of money and a lot of influence, and if he wants it, a pretty big megaphone in Silicon Valley. And he also has a history. He has a history with Gawker itself, because Valley Wag went after his sexual orientation.
Owen Thomas, at this time in charge of Valley Wag, writes an article titled, "Peter Thiel is Totally Gay, People." From the title, seems like it's probably taking cheap shots. It's not. It's actually a very nuanced article about whether or not Silicon Valley is actually that open-minded.
A story that he very much sought to prevent from being posted and, in fact, essentially threatened Gawker from doing about 8 or 9 years before this lawsuit.
The still of Thiel looking angry.
Peter Thiel vowed vengeance, and in a state courtroom in Florida, a continent away, Peter Thiel was determined to get it.
The common perception among straight people is that one's personal life is a personal prerogative. Except that pretty much every single married straight executive with kids will talk about their wife and will talk about their kids and will be asked about their wife and their kids. That's seen as being biographical detail. I'm a gay guy, and to my mind, it is simply insulting for different standards to be applied to gay people than are applied to straight people. I don't see any reason why we should treat it as being something shameful to be kept secret. So I'll push back very, very strongly against that. I think it's good for society that it's clear now that there are gay people everywhere. It's not just fashion designers and celebrity hairdressers, but you have a gay CEO of the most valuable company in the world, Apple. You have the most prominent venture capitalist in Silicon Valley who is gay. He thought that Gawker was uniquely evil. He described Valley Wag as being like a terrorist organization.
Peter Thiel did not give Terry Bollea a case. He did not give him facts. He certainly didn't give the jury the things they considered. Peter Thiel presented an opportunity.
So we found out about recent story in 24 hours with Mr. Thiel.
No clue what they're talking about.
You don't have any idea about
it? No idea.
Most of us found out when Mr. Thiel made himself known. It was never a situation where anybody that was involved on this trial team had any knowledge of any ability of Mr. Thiel to fund for how long. And Mr. Thiel wanted to come forward and help but wanted to remain anonymous. That's fine. The end result is if we can garner the additional help, we certainly would take that opportunity.
He told the New York Times that funding lawsuits to destroy Gawker was the greatest philanthropic thing he's ever done.
The exterior of the National Press Building.
Please help me welcome to the National Press Club to talk about his political choices and motivations, Mr. Peter Thiel. Are you engaged in any other lawsuits against news organizations?
Been involved in the Gawker case, nothing else. And part of my thought was, again, they were a singularly sociopathic bully. My view is that other journalists, other media organizations were not remotely in the same ballpark.
It's no answer for Mr. Thiel to say, I won't do this again. He may not do this again. What he's done is to open a door for other people. What he's done is to legitimize the notion that somebody not involved in a case can, for the purpose of destruction of a publication, fund a litigation which may, and in this case has, had the effect of destroying it. I understand why Mr. Thiel is personally outraged at Gawker, and I'm perfectly willing to accept that he's outraged at what it did in the Hulk Hogan case, as well as his own situation. That doesn't change anything. What he's done is to sort of move the pieces on a chessboard in a way no one's ever done before. What he's done is to potentially imperil entities who upset large, rich, powerful people and institutions. And it's not limited to individuals. This can be corporations.
That was Floyd Abrams.
He claims that he really likes reporters, and he's given $1 million to the Committee to Protect Journalists. I've spoken to the Committee to Protect Journalists. They say they appreciate it, but they don't appreciate, you know, abusing the justice system to go after journalists.
I don't think that the supposed outing story was the reason why he embarked on this. We wrote tons of stories about his feud with Mike Moritz of Sequoia Capital.
We reported on his friends. We reported on Sean Parker's wedding, in which he took over a protected swath of the Redwoods to turn it into some scene from Game of Thrones or The Hobbit, and had everyone dress up in like Merlin the Magician outfits for his wedding, and then ended up having to pay an enormous fine for the damage that he did ecologically to this protected area.
The stuff that I think he's actually really worked up about was the Clarium reporting. You know, he ran a hedge fund called Clarium. It lost 90% of its value over the life of the fund. That is, even by generous standards, really abysmal performance.
Silicon Valley has become a monster of authority and of power in our lives and remains largely invisible.
Silicon Valley billionaires funded by these monopolies now have vastly more power than a fragmented media industry that has lost its most reliable source of revenue, classified ads, has lost that actually to the internet.
We covered Silicon Valley critically, and yes, we were bad for the Valley. Like, yeah. And the reason we were bad for the Valley is because we were telling the truth about the Valley.
Ryan Mack, Forbes.
Peter Thiel does have eccentric beliefs about a number of things.
He has this program called the Thiel Fellowship, and he gives about 20 kids a year $100,000 to drop out of school and pursue an entrepreneurial idea.
The idea behind it is that the U.S. needs to do something to get its innovation engine started again.
Matt Drange, Forbes.
Peter Thiel is a big proponent of seasteading, which he's described as sort of living on an island free of any government interference.
He created an organization called the Seasteading Institute. The whole idea is to create a society offshore, outside the reach of laws. This kind of Ayn Randian libertarian fantasy.
There's so much insane bureaucracy and policies and things that have been built up over decades and decades of worse and worse misgovernment, that if you could actually find a place to do things anew, we all think you could do it so much better.
He has other, maybe even more eccentric beliefs, especially around trying to extend life, like supporting research on whether getting infusions of young people's blood, you know, helps extend your life.
Peter Thiel had spent something like $10,000 to fund James O'Keefe, the guy who's behind the Acorn videos and some other recent advocacy videos.
He seems to have kind of very eccentric views, which tend to be critical of democracy and tend to be in favor of kind of a strong man who can lead humanity to greatness.
The diversity myth.
He co-wrote a book about diversity, just kind of inflammatory, provocative stuff.
The reason we have racial tensions in our society, the reason we have other kinds of tensions, is not because there is a problem with racism and other forms of oppression, but because people are looking for these things too much. If you are dealing with a multicultural educator who is looking for racism everywhere and who's finding racism everywhere, then I think one of the things you might do is you might just stay clear of that person.
He did write about how extending suffrage to women is notoriously tough idea for libertarians.
He thinks democracy is outmoded and inappropriate, particularly since women got the right to vote.
One of the companies that he's deeply involved in, Palantir, I mean, their whole modus operandi is that they gather information on people.
Palantir is a company that analyzes data. The name Palantir comes from The Lord of the Rings. It is kind of like a crystal ball. If you're looking into one of these seeing stones, you can see what's happening where the other ones are.
They initially received an investment from InQtel, which is the CIA's venture capital arm. So they are very closely tied to the national security state.
The crest of the CIA. Houston and Hogan at court.
Around this time, there also started to be more and more, not frivolous, but less than credible lawsuits against Gawker. And most of them had Hogan's head litigator, Charles Harder, at the helm.
Charles Harder was a name not well known outside of Southern California, really, before all this happened. He's an entertainment lawyer, a vigorous representative of figures in Hollywood. In this case, he emerged as somebody willing to play incredibly hardball legal tactics against media outlets. The game he has played legally has taken aback a lot of the First Amendment and a lot of the media company lawyers I've talked to because they just didn't expect the war to be waged so intensely. Charles Harder was also representing Melania Trump.
Charles Harder is a upstanding American citizen about whom I have bad thoughts, but I am not permitted to express them. And I regret those bad thoughts. He is suing me, but he's threatened to sue me for defamation for comments that I made to Forbes magazine in which I suggested I can't say what I suggested because then he'll have another opportunity to attempt to sue me.
Peter Thiel is by no means the first billionaire, the first powerful figure to decide that he wants to influence or pressure the press and how it operates. You can think of the media barons themselves, the Hearsts of the world, the Chandler family out in Los Angeles, the Sulzberger family in New York City. And all of them have had an interest in how the media operates and through that, at times, how the political system works. And you've seen that with Jeff Bezos in sort of a new generation of digital billionaires decide that he wanted to be involved and by all accounts is a pretty remarkable, if conventional, steward of the Washington Post. Peter Thiel's decision to get involved was of a different order. But what he did in financing the suits against Gawker was a kind of adversarial stance and attack that was sheathed from public view.
3, 2, 1. Deborah Ternes.
For folks who are fans of fearless and scrappy press, there were storm clouds brewing at this point.
Excuse me, sit down. You weren't called.
On the national scale, you're going to have essentially a cyclone hit the national press from a figure seemingly beyond reproach, beyond shame, and beyond accountability.
Trump.
Not only is Peter Thiel waging his covert campaign against Gawker, but out in the desert, out in Las Vegas, another figure was quietly, behind the scenes, taking steps to take over the largest and most important news organization in his home state. And he was doing it in a way that would take everyone, including and perhaps especially his own journalists, utterly by surprise.
The fabulous Las Vegas sign and a title, The Review Journal, Las Vegas, Nevada. Jennifer Robison, former reporter, Las Vegas Review Journal.
The Las Vegas Review Journal kind of saw itself as the newspaper of record for Nevada. It wanted to cover all of the key industries, cover the municipalities, cover all of the important stories and cover them in a deep and meaningful manner. It's Nevada's largest media outlet, especially if you look at political and gaming areas.
James Wright, former deputy editor.
December 10th, Jason Taylor, the publisher, is holding what is a routine monthly meeting that he does for all staff. It's a combination rah-rah session, update on how things are going, introducing new employees. They give us snacks. A lot of people like to go to them because, you know, they give us snacks. And it's relatively painless. This one's different, though. I'm walking with a couple of staffers to the other building for the rah-rah session when Mike Hingle yells at me from back behind. So I stopped to go see what he wanted.
I said, you need to make sure there's a reporter at this meeting, and we got to make sure we get a photographer there.
And I just looked at him and said, they've sold the paper, haven't they?
And I said, yep.
Effective today, Gatehouse Media and New Media, our parent company, has sold the Las Vegas Review-Journal.
I told you. And the room just, I mean, just the air was sucked out of it.
It was never a plan, okay? But the opportunity for the shareholders of Gatehouse was too great to pass it up.
Mr. Davis then introduces this man I don't recognize. He does not look the part of a newspaper executive, I'll put it that way. He looks like somebody who perhaps gained a little weight since he bought the suit that he's wearing. I don't think his shirt was tucked in. He looked very uncomfortable. He proceeded to introduce himself as Michael Schroeder, who was the manager, a title that doesn't really exist in the newspaper business, but the manager of News Plus Media LLC, a holding company that's been formed to buy the Las Vegas Review-Journal.
Brian, can I see that paper for a second?
He looks like Peter Griffin from Family Guy.
That's odd.
He was quite the slob. He had his shirt hanging out. He had his pants unbuttoned. He was heavy breathing.
If you had called Central Casting in Hollywood and said, send us an obvious front man, they would send you him. It was so clear, just looking at the guy, that he was not the power. None of these things made any sense whatsoever.
I raised my hand. And I said, who are the investors and what are their expectations?
And Michael Schroeder said words that will always be remembered and probably chiseled onto his tombstone.
We really don't, they want you to focus on your job.
You need to focus on your job.
This is a joke.
You may as well have gone down to the zoo and thrown a bunch of red bloody meat into the lion's cage.
Don't worry about who they are. Just do your jobs. Like, what is our job? That's it.
The entire audience just melted down.
A lot of people were upset. Some probably impolite words were said loudly.
How can you do your job? How can you know what lines you're crossing ethically? Whose interests you're serving inadvertently?
We were going to try to find out who it was. There's just a sense of mission and pride that we have to be the ones that report this.
Staff meet in a newsroom.
There were several reporters in there banging away on this idea, who are they? And we asked, who are they? And Jason said, it's a group of investors. How many are there? He said, about 10. Do you know who they are? Well, I've seen a list, but I can't tell you who they are. I believe people flat out asked him, is the Adelson family involved? And I believe he said no.
Sheldon Adelson. He is... you know, one of the most successful businessmen in the country. You know, he runs some of the largest casino operations in Las Vegas, which is the hub of gaming in the country and the world.
Sheldon Adelson is an American success story. He starts in a suburb of Boston as a poor boy. Clearly, as you listen to him tell the story over the years, here's a guy with a chip on his shoulder. He comes to Las Vegas with the Comdex convention.
Which was back in the early 80s, it was one of the first big computer trade shows ever. He and some partners bought the Las Vegas Sands, a legendary casino in Las Vegas. The Sands was imploded.
The building is demolished.
It's a local spectator sport, we implode things. And the Venetian was built in its place. Class A, great hotel.
Sheldon Adelson was already an extremely successful businessman by anybody's count. But when he went to Macau and he opened his casino there, he really set the gaming industry on its head. And of course, Macau is historically very controversial. It's been a smuggler's paradise. There's triad activity there. There's all kinds of skullduggery that's taken place in Macau historically. But when they decided to allow licensees in this new era, Adelson wound up with one. And he made it work. He immediately rocketed up the charts in terms of personal wealth. Sheldon has found that the more money he makes, the more he is loved by the Republican establishment. He's become downright charming to all these candidates for president. He has a checkbook that essentially won't quit, and so whoever gains his favor is bound to benefit from that politically. So the Adelson primary has become part of the media commentary. You know, who's going to come and kiss the ring this week? And it has made Las Vegas a kind of political center.
Sheldon had a history of asking about buying the paper. He had the deep pockets, and he had the local connection. He was an obvious suspect. And we asked about him several times, and were always put off. No, you know, he's not on the list.
We knew in our gut that it was him.
The staff go through documents.
We just sat down and started going through avenues of how can we figure this out? Let's try to hit the Delaware incorporation documents harder. You know, who do we know? Who are we embedded with that we can talk to? Who are sources in that industry? Basically, it was just really good traditional reporting work that we started to do. Trying to mine data, trying to mine online sources, and hitting up real-life human sources that we'd cultivated over years of reporting.
We had a lot of good reporters on the staff, and the ones who were involved in the reporting of the story were among the best we had. Howard's sources were, you know, he's been doing it for 15, 20 years, gaming reporter. He's one of the best in the country. Jennifer is an outstanding reporter and a really good writer.
I probably would have had to have shot them to keep them from getting involved. They were not going to let the bone go.
As much as journalism is a calling for a lot of us, it's a job, right? And I know for me personally, I could have lost that job. And I would have been able to replace the job. I would have been able to somehow find other income. What I couldn't have fixed would have been the moral stain of looking away in that moment.
We didn't want to just speculate, we wanted to say. So Howard, who has deep sources in the gaming community, was leaning on those sources quite a bit.
Every day we had this steady drumbeat going, you know, trying to shake these people loose. On Wednesday morning, Howard comes in to the office, and he's got his computer bag slung over his shoulder, and he throws it down on his desk, and he's kind of breathless. And he says something like, "We got it. It was the son-in-law. It's the son-in-law."
A smiling young man and woman.
Howard puts the story together as a courtesy, naturally. I moved it along to the publisher and said, "Here we have a finished story. We're ready to run this. And as soon as we get the green light from you, we're ready to go." 2 o'clock turned into 4 o'clock. 4 o'clock turns into 5 o'clock. 5 o'clock turns into 6 o'clock. And I still don't have any approval on this. Finally, about 7 o'clock that evening, we still nothing.
I've seen this in newsrooms before, but usually when there's like a big disaster, everybody came in and everybody stayed, even if they didn't have anything to do. They just wanted to be part of it.
The staff stand in a circle.
For us, the whole issue was preserving and protecting whatever credibility we were going to have left.
I knew it was probably a career-ending decision. I was standing right there when I did it. I mean, I had my computer out. I was going back and forth with the newsroom. You know, it was 7 o'clock, and I'm just waiting for something, either a yes, a no, a maybe, and it never came. So I just said, okay, we need to go with this and let the chips fall.
He said, well, I can't say what he said. It started with an F and ended with the word it.
It was scary. It was scary. But it's what you have to do. It really is. I mean, some stories are worth losing your job over. The web views went like this.
That night, after actually several days of denying that they had bought the paper, the Adelson family issued a statement, and it was added to the paper. John L. Smith, the star columnist of the paper for years and years and years, had butted head with Sheldon Adelson on more than one occasion.
John sits at his laptop.
The story of John Smith in Las Vegas is one of the most rending, compelling stories you'll ever hear about what it means to be a journalist.
My book came out in 2005. Sharks in the Desert was a compilation of chapters on historical figures and hotels and a few issues in the arc of development of the casino industry from its early days, pretty rough and tumble days, to the corporate era. There are a couple chapters that mention Sheldon. The book is not about him. He's just included as one of the characters, as I believe any book on Las Vegas would have to include him as a major character.
He wrote some passages that Adelson took great exception to, and Adelson sued him and his publisher for libel.
I first learned about the litigation while I was in the hospital at Children's Hospital Los Angeles with my daughter, literally in a life and death situation. A major medical crisis with my daughter who had a brain tumor. I took the cell phone and was told that someone asking for $15 million in damage over a line in a book. It was pretty staggering, and it was hard to fathom that the book had generated a lawsuit, first of all. But secondly, it was a little overwhelming, that's for sure. Amelia was a seemingly healthy child who developed headaches and nausea. And in an emergency MRI, there was a brain tumor that was discovered. We had emergency surgery. She had full brain radiation and chemotherapy.
Adelson had an intermediary, a rabbi, call Smith and say, look, I will put a six-figure sum in a bank account for you that your bosses never need to know about that will cover your daughter's medical bills in full, as long as you acknowledge in court that you libeled me.
All I have to do is sign a document that says I intended to defame Sheldon Adelson, which of course, A, I didn't. B, I didn't intend to do that. And if I had signed a document like that, it would have been an invitation to change careers. Crushed my family, crushed, my spirit. Bullies from the schoolyard to Washington, D.C., they always act the same. They bloody the nose of the kid who can get his nose bloodied. They never pick on anyone their own size. I'd rather be known as a guy who went up in weight class. I fought the larger target. We wound up getting a deposition of Adelson for a number of hours. We also gained access to his gaming control board background file, something that's almost never been done in the history of Nevada. It was after that file was read by the judge that their side decided to dismiss this case with prejudice. From that standpoint, you declare victory.
Even when he was at such a point of crisis, John Smith said, this is who I am, this is who I have to be, and this is the only way I can be proud of myself. I've never seen a clearer case since, you don't always recognize heroism when it happens, but my God, what a moment.
Well worn, this is not her today. There's a tremendous burden that my daughter carries. She's got that spirit, she inspires me every day. And the community was beautiful. Well, Las Vegas has this reputation of being this, really cold and hustle-oriented and all of that, and there's a lot of truth there. But when Amelia got sick, the whole community just stepped up, and people were so nice, and they started giving to children's charity.
The press in the real West isn't supposed to be muzzled or corporately controlled. It's supposed to be free-spirited and independent and capable of raising hell in high places. A free and independent press isn't a guarantee, it's a goal. Here's to pursuing that goal like a sinking star on a new moon night in Nevada. My favorite place in the world.
John is clearly moved as he reads.
Upon the appointment of the new publisher, I was immediately ordered not to write about Sheldon anymore. Could not mention his name in my column. Could not mention the family's business in my column. I think I realized that the purchase of the newspaper wasn't designed for my comfort. We'll put it that way.
The Las Vegas Review-Journal, Nevada's largest newspaper, lost another standard bearer this week. John L. Smith, who resigned after citing difficulties with management, spent nearly three decades enlightening, emboldening, and entertaining the Las Vegas community.
From the U.S. House of Representatives. Now at home with Michael Hengel, formerly of the Review-Journal.
Okay, this is the press plate from the December 17th issue in which we broke the story of who the ownership involved. It was by James DeHaven Howard, Jennifer Robeson.
Went in front of the newsroom and told them that I was stepping down.
Of course, they wanted to know whether it was, you know, my decision or whether it was forced. And my response was that, you know, I thought it was just a difficult relationship between them and me. You go out covering a great story, and that's lucky that I had a chance to do that.
His wife nods supportively.
I mean, you've been in this business for a long time.
39 and a half years. I had a hard time holding it together.
It was very difficult. I cried a lot. I cried a lot. I cried when I thought I was going to be fired. And then I cried when it was obvious that I was going to need to leave. It was very difficult.
What the purchase of the Las Vegas Review-Journal did was take off the boards between 20 and 100 people who might reveal something that Sheldon Adelson doesn't like.
Many of the people in this picture were included the team that did the reporting on the sale of the RJ, starting from left here, Eric Hartley gone, me gone, Howard Stutz gone, Jennifer Robeson gone, Jim Wright gone, James DeHaven gone, Bethany Barnes, who was not involved in the reporting, but she's gone, she left too. Colton, still there.
Michael looks unhappy. A title, the Gawker offices.
I'm on the verge of personal bankruptcy, and the company had to file for bankruptcy last month in order to protect it from creditors. My first priority is to get the Gawker brands, Deadspin, Jezebel, Kotaku, Jalopnik, Lifehacker, Gizmodo, and the 200-plus people that work supporting those properties, getting those people to a safe place under new ownership, to a place where Peter Thiel can't come after them.
If he was here, he's not. If he just walked out as a surprise guest, what would you say to him?
It's like, you bankrupted the company, you bankrupted me personally. Why are you still going after Sam Biddle, a journalist, John Cook, our executive editor? Why are you targeting individual journalists? Because you're upset with coverage.
A title announces Cleveland, Ohio, and a march in progress. America was never free. Peter Thiel strides out onto a stage.
Good evening. I'm Peter Thiel. I build companies and I support people who are building new things, from social networks to rocket ships. I'm not a politician, but neither is Donald Trump. He is a builder, and it's time to rebuild America.
Donald Trump, who is, of course, being supported by Peter Thiel, says that he wants to open up the libel laws. He wants to make it easier to sue newspapers.
USA Today did a really important piece about the 3,500 lawsuits that Donald Trump has been involved with in one way or another.
I think the media is among the most dishonest groups of people I've ever met.
Donald Trump, Peter Thiel, and other billionaires have been trying to undercut the press, undercut the First Amendment, undercut freedom of speech.
I think the common thread among the Peter Thiel story, the Adelson story, and the Trump story is billionaires who are proclaiming, we are not vulnerable to truth. We are invulnerable to the facts. And it simply doesn't matter what you say, what the press does. We are more powerful than the truth.
The Fox News decision desk has called Pennsylvania for Donald Trump. This means that Donald Trump will be the 45th president of the United States.
CNN can report that Hillary Clinton has called Donald Trump to concede the race.
Donald Trump presents a really trying situation for American citizens. Trump has done a number of things that should give us a great deal of cause for concern. Among them are his lack of transparency, his inaccessibility, his extremely harsh criticism and even abuse of journalists.
When
you're
I
raising money for
money,
veterans.
Excuse me. I've watched you on television. You're a real beauty.
Immigrants on the whole
Try getting it out.
I'll get it out.
I mean, I don't know if you're going to put this on television, but you don't even know what you're talking about.
He's really been vociferous in his criticism of the press.
Is this what it's going to be like covering you if you're president?
Yeah, it is.
We're going to have this kind of confrontation in the press room?
Okay, yeah, it is going to be like this, David.
In general, he's called the media and reporters scum. He has said over and over and over again that they're dishonest, that they're corrupt.
They don't want to give it straight because the press are liars. They're terrible people.
These are the most dishonest human beings right back.
He's urged his followers at rallies to turn to the press pen and shout things out that were abusive. He's actually put people in danger.
She's back there, little Katie. She's back there. What a lie it was.
During the campaign, he had a blacklist of media organizations, including the Washington Post, the Des Moines Register, Politico, BuzzFeed, that he prohibited from getting press credentials in the usual way to come to his rallies and speeches.
Can you give us a chance to ask a question, sir?
Go ahead.
Sir, can
Quiet.
You state, can you, Mr. President-elect,
go ahead.
Can you state categorically,
she's asking a question.
Mr. President-elect, can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
You're attacking us. Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
Can you give us a question?
I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you state categorically?
You are fake news.
We just can't predict how much President Trump is going to be prepared to do to implement what we do know will be his anger at some of the coverage of him.
Donald Trump tweeting this morning, taking on the New York Times.
I mean, there's no way that he will not be filled with fury at things that some, maybe most, newspapers will say.
Armed police in full armor guard Trump Tower.
What we can't predict is what will his advisors say to him.
Peter Thiel, the Silicon Valley venture capitalist and investor, one of the early Trump supporters, going to visit the president-elect.
He's been so terrific and so outstanding, and he got just about the biggest applause at the Republican National Convention. He's ahead of the curve, and I want to thank you, man. You have a very special guy.
What will his children say to him? How far down the road of suppression, there's no other word, he'd be prepared to go to punish entities that anger him.
If a President Trump were to come after a journalist the way the candidate Trump came after me, I think it could be potentially dangerous.
Without a meaningful application of the First Amendment, you have a true risk of living in a suppressive state, of living in a country in which a president who thinks he's doing the right things, they always do, who thinks that his critics are harming the country, they always do, can limit the ability of the press, the willingness of the press to expose, to criticize, and the like. There is enough chance that the president will be upset enough, angry enough, vengeful enough to try to take whatever actions he thinks he can to punish those who have offended him. And we're talking about the highest, most powerful institution in the world, which is the executive branch of the United States government.
Repeat after me. I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability
preserve, protect, and defend
the Constitution of the United States so help me God Congratulations, Mr. President.
Yeah! President Trump embraces his family.
We have a very threatening situation. We have a man in power, President of the United States, who doesn't seem to care about the distinction between true and false.
I get up this morning, I turn on one of the networks, and they show an empty field.
This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period.
It's possible we are sliding towards authoritarian rule in the United States, which is a shocking thing to say, but there are many signs that it's true.
It's gotten to a point where it's not even being reported.
This is something that we need journalists to try and oppose.
Kellyanne, CNN and other media organizations cover terrorism around the world all the time, saying that we don't cover terrorism. That's just false.
When they are in this position where they're sort of on the front lines of the slide towards authoritarianism, just trying to do their job turns them into the opposition.
Look, alternative facts are not facts. They're falsehoods.
At the moment, you're seeing a surreal scene in Washington where you have, to an unprecedented degree in the modern age, a White House willing to blast the press as an adversary on an hourly basis.
The leaks are absolutely real. The news is fake because so much of the news is fake. So
this is a moment of real definition for the press.
A modern newsroom.
You know, journalism has to be independent. Journalism has to stand on its own ground. Journalism has to be humble about its own shortcomings. It has to be transparent about how it reaches conclusions and have those be earned conclusions.
Thank you for listening.
Presented fairly. But it has to be tough-minded, too.
Reporting is the only job specifically listed in the Bill of Rights as protected. It is a sacred public trust, a vital civic function. Truly the Fourth Estate, the watchdog over the powerful. Without good, strong journalism, you don't have a healthy democracy.
Writes, the president believes that a free and independent press is a threat to the country.
And we demand to know the answer to this question. You owe this to the American people.
Here's a message to the White House. You keep lying, we're going to keep reporting.
The job that I had is about speaking truth to power. It's about standing up. You know, one of the things that makes it a republic is that we're not supposedly ruled by the elite class. And the only way to hold people to account, whether it's government or corporation, is to be able to dig without being crushed under the rubble of it.
A banner says love trumps hate. Banners are held high as thousands march the streets.
A reporter gets the story. A reporter goes over, under, around to get the facts, to get the truth. What does it matter if you don't have 100 journalists turning over rocks, telling people things that they couldn't find out on their own? It matters a lot. It's part of the bedrock of democracy.
One of the things that I will forever be proud of is the fact that I pissed off a billionaire enough for him to vindictively destroy my company.
To help protect our water and air for our generations and my kids' generations. Do you believe in science?
Because that's a pretty good job description. Like, if you're not pissing off a billionaire, then there's not much point.
Does not seem to respect the idea of accountability.
Journalism is worth protecting. The press represents the public. If we lose it, we've lost what America actually is and stands for. Journalists need to remember why they got into this business, to tell the truth.
We will not walk in fear.
To go up against powerful institutions, to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted, and keep their roles in mind and do them better than they've ever done them before. The stakes are very high. We have to fight harder than ever, and we have to fight smarter than ever.
Protesters are confronted by riot cops. Trump speaks, and a photographer wears armor and a helmet in a war zone. A quote, "Our liberty depends on the freedom of the press, and that cannot be limited without being lost." Thomas Jefferson, 1786. Written and directed by Brian Knappenberger. Cinematography by Scott Sinkler and Jason Blaylock. Original music by Garen Chang. Edited by Andrew McAllister. Executive producers Ben Kottner, Zaina Lauren, Lisa Nishimura, Brian Knappenberger. Producers Brian Knappenberger, Femke Volting, Carol Ann Madison. Further credits scroll. copyright 2017 Journalism Project, LLC. All rights reserved. This motion picture is protected by copyright and other applicable laws of the United States of America and other nations. Any unauthorized duplication, distribution, or exhibition of this motion picture, including soundtrack, is prohibited and could result in criminal prosecution as well as civil liability. Journalism Project, LLC is the author of this motion picture for the purpose of copyright and other laws. Letters pop out from a white background, then turn red. Netflix.